You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, April 7th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How are you guys doing today?
All righty.
What's up?
Very tired. Thank you, Steve.
We have an interview with David Gorski coming up a little bit later in the show.
This is a special week, guys, because the protons are flowing. The LHC, as they hit the on switch, and stuff's happening.
Don't cool. you want to hear so that far, so rev good. Up, Bob? I just got to hear that thing turn on once.
It sounds like this. Wait, start. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, crank start.
That's a good one, Steve.
Right. Yeah, that what'll be more interesting is the science that comes out of it.
Yeah, we'll analyze the results and have them in about 18 months, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, but besides there's another thing that they may find that I read besides the potential for extra dimensions or new cousins to the Higgs boson and evidence for supersymmetry and other things. I found today that they may find something called unparticles, which they're called unparticles, which are very bizarre, and I still need to learn a lot more about. But they may be implicated in the magic of superconductivity. So now the LHC may find or deepen our understanding of superconductivity, which would be awesome.
They're also going to be exploring dark matter.
Yep.
Now that's fascinating.
Hey, we're at Nexus right now.
Oh, yeah. Hey, there you go.
Oh, wow. Well,
when you listen to this, we will be.
Yes, that's correct. And in podcast time.
When this podcast comes out, we'll be probably recording our live show.
But let's go on with this show. Bob, tell us about this week's forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, this week's superhero is Fazlur Rahman Khan. 1929 to 1982, he was a Bangladeshi-American architect and structural engineer, and his architectural breakthrough in tubular designs for skyscrapers made the existence of super tall buildings a reality. Ever hear of him?
Nope.
Not new.
Nope. Khan was born in Bangladesh. He received a master's and PhD in structural engineering and then a master's also in applied mechanics. Two of those masters he got actually in like 3 years. Smart guy. He, in 1960, I didn't know this, but in 1960, architects really only had a few options for designing tall buildings. Once you got above 20 or 30 stories, there was a problem. It became increasingly inefficient, costly, and dangerous. So it was a problem. So he came up in that time frame, he came up with his tubular design idea. Now the idea is that you're using the outer perimeter of walls to simulate the strong, efficient tubes that are now fairly ubiquitous that give this building so much more strength. And this technique is actually used in almost all buildings taller than 40 stories. I mean, it was a renaissance that this guy caused. So the benefits, though, is not just taller buildings. There's plenty of benefits that flow from just this tubular design. First off, they can withstand more lateral loads like wind and earthquakes. How important is that?
Very.
That's a key factor in all super tall buildings. How is it going to react to the wind and how's it going to react to earthquakes? Huge considerations. This design uses less costly material. Yet they could stand far taller than ever before. And also because of this efficient use of space, the available interior of the buildings jumped dramatically with his design. So you've got more square footage per unit area in the building, which is, I mean, how huge is that in terms of just selling real estate and offices and things like that and just for living conditions?
Fewer columns needed to support the floors and everything.
Yeah, it really opened things up. And then finally, his design allowed for more creativity, in the design. So basically he changed buildings from these box-like structures to be more like a sculpture. You could really kind of tweak it and make it look even more beautiful than just a standard old box. And, so this guy had a tremendous, tremendous impact. At that time, super tall buildings they had like a 30-year like hiatus. It was a lull. There really wasn't a lot going on until his idea of the tubular design, which has many little variations depending on what you want to accentuate in your building. Until that came out, they were really in the doldrums. And, so it's no wonder that he's been called the Einstein of structural engineering. And finally, if you're wondering, well, what did he design? He designed the Sears Tower, which is now the Willis Tower, which was the world's tallest building from its completion in 1974, up until the Petronas Towers, were finished in 1996. So remember Fazlur Khan? Mention him to your friends. Maybe when discussing the role spandrels play in forming load-resisting spatial skeletons.
Guys, tell me what this sound is.
Briefcase opening?
Deck of cards thumbing through it.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a lock of a briefcase being unlocked.
Yeah, but it's a double click. It's a weird double click.
That's the sound of my new D7200 camera taking a picture.
Nice.
Okay.
Is that a mirrorless, Steve?
No, it's a DSLR. It's the, just came out, the D7200. It's Nikon's latest sort of prosumer camera.
So that sound to you is like sweet, isn't it?
Like butter. I've been waiting for this for so long. And I actually pre-ordered it. And so I would get it the earliest possible moment it was available. And so I'm tracking it, right? I'm tracking it on Amazon. And it says it's on the way. And it just never showed up. So eventually I had to call them and to find out what the hell was going on. And they basically concluded that it was lost.
They lost it,
which means that somebody stole it. You know, somebody just walked away with that sucker. So they sent me a new one. I just got it today. So I had to wait an extra agonizing week to get my hands on this camera.
Oh, my God. I hate that.
Oh, my gosh.
How many megapixels?
24.
What?
Oh, my God. 24.
That is 24? Huge. Oh, my God. That's going to give you an enormous amount of flexibility when you want to crop and zoom in and everything, Steve.
That's pretty standard now. If you look at all the latest cameras, the DSLRs or even the mirrorless ones, 24, it's pretty standard now.
Do your old lenses work with it?
Yes, that's partly why I got it. I have more money in lenses than in the body.
Yep.
Why didn't you go mirrorless?
Specifically because I wanted to be able to use my existing lenses without an adapter. You can often get an adapter. So anyway, Jay and I purchased a mirrorless camera to take video with our Lumix GH4.
Lumix.
An incredible mirrorless digital camera, but it's actually, they included in the software optimization for video. So it's actually a great video camera, you know? Wow. You could shoot a movie with that thing.
Yeah, well, the GH4 is, this was the version that had film in mind.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a converted still camera. This camera is, and the quality is so incredible.
We took it to Australia and New Zealand with us as our primary video camera.
Where we shot about 800 hours of video.
The wonderful thing is now this technology is so miniaturized. It's light. It's, the battery lasts a long time. It has a huge amount of storage.
Affordable. This is not out of the reach of, I think, average consumers. Yeah, you're going to spend a little more money, but years ago to get something even close to that, which is not even good enough, is today, you'd spend tens of thousands of dollars.
Oh, Evan, I remember on equipment. Because you worked for an equipment rental company. You brought a camera to one of our New England Skeptical Society meetings to film it. And the camera, which again is not even as good as what we can, like a consumer can get today, the camera cost $100,000.
With the lens, that's right.
With the lens.
$100,000.
Yep. That's the kind of money you needed to have sort of a high end video.
A television broadcast quality piece of equipment.
Now, $2,000-$3,000, you could be all set.
Wow. Yeah. So that's huge. That's a big indicator.
Speaking of technology, Jay.
Yes.
I understand that we've made somewhat of a milestone in another type of technology.
Yeah. So the first driverless car ended up driving across the entire country. So it took 9 days. It started in San Francisco and ended up in New York City. And this was really, it was one hell of an accomplishment, even though many companies could have done it, to be honest with you, because that's how many companies have been working on the technology. It just happens to be that this company, Delphi, was the first to use their technology and essentially drive across the entire country. So 3,400 miles, it went through 15 states. And the car was only helped by a human when they left the highway because they just didn't want anything to happen to it in the more difficult traffic.
So that means there was a person in the car for the entire ride and
there has to be.
Over.
Yep. They swapped out. I think they had six people that they were rotating during the whole trip.
Right, following it with a bus or something.
Jay, sure. The writer for Wired, Alex Davies, who wrote about this, made an interesting point. He said what's revolutionary about this is not that one company did this, but that many companies could have done it. The fact that many companies could have done it, that's the interesting thing. This technology is there. This wasn't just an extreme feat by one company out on the edge. This is now tried and true technology.
Absolutely. Well, all the major car manufacturers are working on driverless technology, and companies like Delphi are making just the technology that can be installed in any car. And I think their goal is to sell their technology to car manufacturers that, you know, that haven't been working on it, or, you know, this company has fantastic technology. They put this into an Audi SQ5. You know why, guys?
Why?
Just because the car looks cool.
That's like, why'd you build it into a DeLorean? Why wouldn't you put it in a DeLorean? Yeah.
So companies that, you've heard, of course, Google has been working feverishly on this, Audi and Mercedes. But, you know, like I said, a lot of other big car manufacturers globally are working on this. They all know it's coming. They all know, you know, essentially what the time frame is. You know, everybody's saying 3 to 5 years for the first cars to probably hit the market, as long as all the laws and regulations have been worked out. But they're not saying, you know, it really won't be like something that we don't even look twice at until 2040. That's when it's really going to be rolled out and it'll be everywhere.
2040, you think?
That's what the experts are saying. I mean, I think that seems like very far away, but
that's far away. That's 25 years away. That seems way too long.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of legality. You know, maybe it'd only be legal in certain states, and it'll slowly roll out. The car companies are not in a mad rush. From what I was reading, you know, they're all testing like crazy, and they're not just trying to get something to market. Like, they're all, I guess, waiting for someone to do it, but it is going to come. In the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to see something hit the market. Some type of thing will hit the market somewhere.
So for 2040, is that a 100% driverless car? Is that what you're saying? Like, you're sitting in the back? Or is that for systems that assist the driver, but you still need a driver behind the wheel?
I think by 2040, we will have completely zero interface driverless cars, no steering wheel, no nothing.
The Johnny Cab.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about here. There's a lot of cool
Tom
things.
Tom Cruise in Minority Report.
So when you think about, like, what's it going to be like? I've thought about this quite a bit. I enjoy reading articles about this because the speculation is really, like, we're having a change. Like, this is not as big as the internet, but it is similar in concept. You think about, to its core, it's going to change the way we think about things, the way we handle making trips, you know, commuting to work, going to the store, all the things that you use your car for are going to change. And in the beginning, you'll have to have someone sitting at the driver wheel, you know, ready to take over in an instant. But what's going to happen? You're going to be on the phone, you're going to be talking, you know, and these car companies know people are just going to go blank even though there's a steering wheel in there. As soon as the car can drive itself and after you get over the initial shock, you're going to forget about it. And then they'll make cars that probably have more backseat space, you know, more luxury things going on, like, you know,
a bed. Put a bed in the damn car. Take a trip across the country.
How long before the first car comes on the market that doesn't even have a driver's seat? You know what I mean? It can't be driven by a person. It's 100% self-driving.
I say 15 years.
2041.
See, I would 2040 sounds right for that.
Yeah.
You know, 25 years. It's always hard to say, but, you know, before, I do think we're going to have a period where it's going to be computer assisted driving, but the driver will be involved. And then there'll be a period where it can self drive 100%, but there still has the capability of being driven by a person. And then finally, you'll have cars that can only be self driven and that are not designed at all to be driven by a human.
I think what'll end up happening is cars that have driverless technology will end up costing less for insurance because their driving record will destroy any type of driving capabilities of humans. Now keep this in mind, guys. And this is the part that is just so awesome, is that first of all, unlike a person, the car can't get distracted. It can't get fatigued. The technology will always be reading every corner of the car. It'll be seeing things that a human could never see. And once you really start to let that sink in, you're like, wow, this car can see in every direction. It can actually network to other cars if they do this. I hope that they push this technology where it's talking to other cars on the network, knowing what's hidden behind corners that it can't even see. It'll have a predictive kind of nature to it where it'll know that there's a car barreling down Main Street.
Yeah.
That's behind a building from where you are.
Traffic will be one organism. Yep. Essentially, not individual cars. They'll all be working together.
Now, imagine this, though. This is also kind of freaky to me. You get in your car and you tell your car, we all live in Connecticut. If you could picture the United States, and you say to your car, take me to this location in Florida. And the car is going to map it and start driving, and you literally go to sleep in the back of the car. The car eventually... is particularly with electric cars, the car could eventually refuel itself or recharge itself without you even having to get involved. It just pulls over to a bay.
With electric cars.
Yeah. Here's a question. See that. Can you instruct the car to speed?
Yeah, that'll be an interesting...
Or will people take over just so they could speed?
Yeah.
Sure. Yes, people will take over to speed. I think no doubt about that.
That's an awesome question, Steve. Oh, my God. Well, so when you get a driverless car, do you have a knob that says max speed 60? No, max speed 75. You know, I don't know.
Or will it be going 25 in those back roads, you know, where everyone drives 40? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Can you imagine?
It may, and there, who knows? They may pass laws in which they're going to regulate your car to obey those laws strictly. You may not have a choice.
Yeah.
If legislation
that really sucks.
Seems
that sucks because think about it. You go these back roads that are 25. You will never go 20. I don't care who you are. You do not go 25.
Bob, they might change the speed limits for driverless cars because of how much safer they are. Keep that in mind. Here's another thing.
Yeah.
It's always,
maybe, but you're still
it's always the 5 minutes late. Or five, you know, you're saving 5 minutes when you speed for most of your routes. If you're even lucky, you save 5 minutes, and it's not worth
the
risk.
Lights, right?
It's never worth the risk. So what? So it takes 5 minutes longer to get to where you're going. Who cares?
It just feels like
we're still humans.
Feels
slower.
It's painful. It's painful.
Yeah, but you won't care because you're going to be watching TV, playing video games, catching up on work, sleeping,
having
talking,
sex,
doing whatever you want in the car.
Yeah, hell.
Now, how about this, guys? Here's a really, really, really cool idea. So what about the idea of multi-owner or no-owner car? So check this out. You need a car. You call a car.
Like Uber, but these drive.
Without the threat of being raped.
Yeah, you could have one car that services your whole family as an example. You know, maybe not you don't actually own a car, but let's say like your car in the morning, it drives you to work and it drives back home. And then the car just comes and picks you up and it doesn't.
Yeah.
And it could give 100 trips to other people during that time span as well. Like,
I don't know. You want to share a car, you know, take your chances and some real smelly sort of person had been in the car before you. And then you got to drive around in a smelly car.
As Jay was saying, if you have a family car, though, it gives you lots of options. Like the car doesn't have to be where you are. I could be at work and my car could go pick up my daughter from school and bring her home and then come back and be ready for me to go home. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. So just gives you lots of options. Also, there's lots of people who can't or shouldn't be driving.
Yeah. Elderly.
The elderly. I mean, I have told a lot of patients it's time to stop driving and they're never happy about it. Let me tell you.
No.
I'm sure we all know people that we could think of without naming any names that probably shouldn't be driving anymore.
Hi, Dad. Dad.
Oops, I'm sorry.
Get a little concerned about the fact. It's like, when are we going to get to that point where we're like, nope, the driving's got to stop. You know, that's tough. It's tough.
Not just that. We lose about, 35,000 people a year in the United States on the roads. That's the amount of Americans we lost approximately in Vietnam War. Every year we have like a Vietnam War in this country. In road deaths, all of that will shrink to virtually nothing. That's huge.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like let's say that every 100 yards, there's a camera that any car that drives by could just tap into just to see surrounding area, whatever, just to give it a little bit more information.
Now we're talking.
Help. These types of things could be ubiquitous, like cell towers, you know, whatever.
But also, not only that, Jay, but other cars. Again, if every car and the roads make up one technological organism where every car has access to all of the video information of every other car, as well as maybe some fixed street cameras, that real-time information about the conditions of the roads or accidents or other positions of other cars or weather, whatever, your car could have access to all of that as it needs it. It could reroute when necessary.
Yeah.
it's, you know, just think of a fusion between your GPS device, your mapping device, and a self-driving car, and, you know, crowdsourcing sites that tell you about traffic and et cetera. It'll all just be one seamless thing.
When we're talking about technology like this, I think 2040 perhaps is a realistic time frame for those sorts of
before it's fully realized. Probably have fully realized self-driving cars. Okay. But I think we'll have steps along the way long before then.
This is a big one. Yeah. Big step.
I think so. I think it's going to change how we get around. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Let's move on. I'm going to just discuss a quick short item. Recently, Matthew Fisher published a series of experiments where he was looking at the effect of searching online on our confidence in our knowledge about a topic. So this is interesting. Again, not surprising, but what I like about the series of experiments he did was that he really tried to control for variables. So basically, he found that when you give people questions, factual questions, and then you ask them about how confident they are in their answer, if they searched online for information about the answer, that increased their level of confidence. But here's what's interesting. That makes perfect sense. You think, okay, sure. If you just read something, you're going to be confident in your answer. But what he did was he compared searching online to being told where to go online. In other words, like, go to this URL and you could read information on this topic. He compared searching online to being given information in hard copy offline. And he did experiments where people were allowed to search online, but the topic that they were given doesn't exist. And so there's no information online. Or it's a real topic, but they filtered out any actual information about the topics from the search results so that you wouldn't find any useful information online. So even when people were searching for non-existent topics, or when they were not actually getting access to information, or when people were getting access to the same information offline or being directed to it, the act of searching as an isolated variable, as best as he could do in this one, you know, series of experiments, seemed to significantly increase people's confidence in their knowledge, which is interesting, right? This is the Google University effect, right? This, people think because they've gone online and they went searching for the information that this gives them a level of expertise and knowledge that they don't have. So we encounter this all the time, but it's just interesting that scientists, psychologists are starting to really tease apart a lot of these new effects that we're seeing because of social media and the power of the internet. What I think is interesting, it wasn't explicitly discussed in the studies, but, you know, why would the act of searching have such a powerful effect? I think part of it is confirmation bias. People aren't aware that when they're actively searching for information, that enables them to select the information that reinforces what they want to believe. In the extreme, this leads to the echo chamber effect, which I think we've talked about before on the show. There are communities on the internet that are essentially formalized confirmation bias. You know, like the anti-vaccine community. If you go to an anti-vaccine website, it's all people who believe the anti-vaccine mantra. They filter out any disconfirming information. It's all information that seems to support their position, or interpretations of information that supports their position, and other opinions are filtered out, and it just becomes a massive echo chamber. But these people think that they've quote unquote done the research, that they understand the issues, but they really don't. They're just being fed a narrative that's being reinforced. And so this, I think, is one piece of that, the notion that the searching itself actually gives this illusion of, I have access to this vast body of knowledge, therefore I have a vast body of knowledge, you know, which is interesting. So this, like unintended psychological consequence.
So what do you have to do to counteract that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. So I think, and I know I've said this before on the show, I think one thing you need to do is specifically search for information that goes against either what you already believe or the story or the narrative that is emerging when you search. Like if I'm searching on a topic and I'm finding information all pointing in one direction, then I'll start to specifically go out of my way. So, well, is anyone saying the opposite, or what are the people who have the opposite opinion? What are they saying? And only what, you know, only then do I feel like I'm sort of wrapping my head around the whole issue. Sometimes until you search for that other information, you don't realize that you're being fed only one narrative that may either you're finding because of the biased way in which you're searching, or is just more popular on the internet. And so it's presenting you with a biased access to information. So the information online, the probability of getting to that information, how high it floats to the top in searches, does not necessarily reflect the scientific reliability of that information. Although Google really tries hard to make it do that, it's not necessarily the case. It's still a popularity contest above all else. So, all right, Evan, I understand that aliens are big.
They are ginormous, supposedly.
Maybe. Supposedly, speculatively.
Cosmologist Fergus Simpson of the University of Barcelona has proposed that intelligent extraterrestrials are more likely to be larger in size compared to humans, and perhaps quite significantly larger in both weight and physical size.
What?
Yes.
I don't buy his argument at all. I don't even get it.
Well, here's the gist of it. I was going to read for you the abstract from his paper, but I'll try to narrow it down just into one paragraph here and paraphrase. Simpson and his team has come up with a mathematical model that that assumes, like here on Earth or any other similar planet to Earth that's out there, relatively larger animals on that planet will need more resources and expend more energy, which means there will be overall less types of those animals. So larger means less. We have hundreds of thousands of beetles in the order Coleoptera. But there are only 86 species of whales, dolphins, and porpoises combined in the order Cetacea. From the article, which was published in Newsweek, it reads that Simpson says that a certain minimum size is probably necessary for intelligent life, and he used the range of body sizes found in animals on Earth to come up with the most probable distribution of organisms on other planets. But apparently he was not able to take into consideration certain things, for example, body mass compared to the planet's surface gravity, and also certain evolutionary aspects of all of this.
Yeah, like evolution.
and we got one data set to work with. It's very limited. It's an interesting thought experiment, I would say. I don't know that you could necessarily derive just a pure mathematical means of arriving at that kind of conclusion, though.
Yeah, but I don't even get his logic. So as far as I can understand it, he's saying that because there are more smaller creatures, we are more likely to fall, humans are more likely to fall on the small end of the spectrum, which means that an alien could be bigger. So that we're probably below average in size for intelligent creatures. But wouldn't the aliens be subject to the same statistical distribution, right?
I would think
so. If there's more smaller than larger creatures, doesn't that mean that there's more likely to be smaller intelligent aliens? Right? Yeah. What am I missing here? I don't get his logic.
Well, why would you think that, Steve?
He's saying if you look at the size distribution of animals, the smaller you get, the more different kinds of species there are. Therefore, we are more likely to be in this from the small end of the spectrum just because there's more smaller.
So are they.
Species. But so are they. Yeah, I don't get it. Why would aliens be from the larger end of the spectrum?
Because they're scary.
Yeah, but I just don't understand the logic. I just think he made a mistake. I just don't see it.
If I'm wrong
and somebody can explain to me why I'm wrong, please do so, because I could not understand what his logic was.
He writes in the abstract, since, again, this is an Earth-based formula, since population density is widely observed to decline with increasing body mass, we conclude that most intelligent species are expected to exceed 300 kilograms, roughly 650 pounds. So, right.
No, wrong.
that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. All the other points are more interesting. The fact that We have no idea what aliens are going to look like. Let's face it. We simply have no idea. We are going from one data point. And evolution is so quirky and contingent. And there are so many different kinds of life and body plans just on Earth. Imagine what the results of completely independent evolutionary history would be. I just don't think we can say anything about what alien species are going to look like. Even technological intelligent ones.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we may be able to derive some basic rules. Like, yeah, they're more likely to be terrestrial than aquatic because it's hard to have technology like fire underwater. Okay. There may be some broad rules like that we can derive. But even then, I bet you we'll be surprised.
I'm sure we will, Steve, because, you know, just on Earth alone, you know, we have such an amazing variety. And there are creatures that exist on this planet that I think are creepy looking. So I can't imagine, like, you know, evolution happening on a different planet under completely different circumstances with different conditions and everything. Yeah, there's no way. I mean, it might have some kind of movement that we're familiar with. You know, to say that it would be human shaped and have a similar makeup, maybe they don't even have to move.
What if it's more of a colony-based sort of intelligence in which you've got these things which don't necessarily have brains like we understand it? We associate large brains with intelligence and being able to make the leaps and scientifically and otherwise that we have. But what if it's rather a matter of quantity and you've got all these tiny, tiny, tiny little whatever creaturelets acting in concert, pure concert with one another to make these unbelievable technological, incredible things.
Like the Borg.
A hive mind, yep. Hosts.
Yeah, you could have a hive mind.
Parasites, all that good stuff.
I would hate that. I wouldn't want to be a part of the Borg.
No.
No, but I'm sure there's some people out there that would like to be in some type of collective. God knows they're trying to do it on their own, you know, without them being wired up together. But that would really suck if you think about it. I mean, who the hell wants to... I mean, you're not fully there then in a way, right?
You know, as we understand it.
Yeah.
Jay, man, you know what you have.
They may enjoy that.
You'd have no idea. You would think we were weird. I mean, think of that podcast we listened to called The Things, where it was basically the movie The Thing, but from the alien's perspective. And that creature could not wrap its head around, a singular organism like humans. It couldn't even barely imagine what it was like to be like us, and it would be, you know, to them, infinitely preferable to be a sort of colony creature, of course.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, you're going to tell us why a lot of things on Earth died.
Yeah, this was a nasty extinction. The end of the Triassic mass extinction pretty much ravaged much of the life all over the Earth 200 million years ago. Now, new clues seem to reveal that a poisoned ocean may have been the culprit for the massive loss of sea life. So of the five great mass extinctions we've identified in Earth's history, the end Triassic, for various reasons, is pretty much the least well-known extinction. Most mysterious of all is not the terrestrial extinction, but the extinctions that happened in the sea, in the oceans. That's the one that's even more like, you know, what the hell, what happened down there? Some people say maybe it was a meteor, but there's really no evidence of that. Some think it might have been the volcanism that was happening at the time. And to me, that seems a little bit more likely. But, you know, but how did that really play into what happened to the sea life? So researchers were looking at fossilized bacteria, a very special kind of bacteria, off the coast of British Columbia and Canada. Now, that part of the Earth today was actually part of the bottom of the Panthalassa Ocean 200 million years ago. And that was one of the oceans, one of the two oceans, I believe, that were around the supercontinent Pangaea 200 million years ago. And if you look, this is called green sulfur bacteria. And they were key. They were a very critical find for them because they only live in extremely oxygen-deprived environments. They also are associated with hydrogen sulfide, which is that rotten egg smell. But that chemical, hydrogen sulfide, it just doesn't really smell really bad. It's essentially a poison that also happens to be corrosive, flammable, and explosive. So it's just nasty stuff.
Other than that, it's great.
Yeah, you do not want to be swimming around in that. So, and also, this is somewhat important as well. The researchers also noted that nitrogen levels in the organic matter at that time changed significantly, which means that essentially that the flow of nutrients during this low oxygen period, they were also severely impacted. So, all right. So this is the picture, as best I could tell, that they're putting together now for what happened. So Pangaea was beginning to break up, at this time. Due to, of course, the tectonic plate movement. The rifts that were all over the place, between these plates were spewing out huge amounts of CO2 into the environment. Now, this CO2 would impact the oceans, by lowering the oxygen content and then also changing the circulation and making them more acidic. Now, this environment, was preferential to microbes like the green sulfur bacteria, causing them to proliferate and also raising the levels of the poisonous hydrogen sulfide. Now, this leads to a cool term called photic zone euxinia, PZE, photic zone euxinia. And that essentially is just the double whammy poisoning of water with the hydrogen sulfide and the low oxygen levels. When those things occur at the same time, bam, you've got this PZE phenomenon. They've suspected that PZE was around at that time, but because it's been hinted at in some of the other evidence that they've gathered, but they thought it was only a localized phenomenon. It just something that wasn't all over the place. And the key evidence here now is that, or the key finding here is that this is the first evidence that this was a global phenomena. And could very well have been the significant or the critical cause of the massive marine die-off. And that's essentially the bottom line. So the most important aspect of this, however, it's not just potentially figuring out, you know, the coup de grace that wiped out most of the sea life back then.
Coup de grace.
Coup de grace, yeah.
I was thinking.
See, I hate when that happens because I was thinking, wait, was it? I know that we were wrong, but I didn't know if coup de grace was also acceptable. Yeah. Was that? But it's only. I mean, it's just flat out wrong. I just
coup de grace is wrong.
I don't like the sound of it. All right, coup de grace. All right,
it's like Mardi Gras.
No, it's Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras means Fat Tuesday. Coup de grace means the blow of grace.
Of
if you say coup de grace, you're saying the blow of fat.
Wait, but that's what I meant. Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right, guys. So the most important aspect of this, however, is it's not just potentially figuring out the coup de grace that wiped out much of the sea life 200 million years ago. It's the application to the current day, to the here and now. Can this actually happen again in the not too distant future? And could we actually have a hand in having it happen? That's a big question. So I'll end with a quote from Professor Jessica Whiteside of the University of Southampton. She is also the co-author of the study. She said, "The release of CO2 was probably at least as rapid as that caused by the burning of fossil fuels today, although the initial concentrations were much higher in the Triassic. The consequences of rapidly rising CO2 in ancient times inform us of the possible consequences of our own carbon dioxide crisis." So, yeah. I mean, we are putting out as much, according to Whiteside, as much CO2 as was happening back then. Although, keep in mind that their initial concentrations, of course, were much higher. But still,
yeah.
I mean, that just means we've got to do it for longer. And man, not good.
Well, speaking of extinction, I came across a very interesting article called, here's the title of the study, "A Specimen Level Phylogenetic Analysis of Taxonomic Revision of Diplodocidae."
God, I hate those overly superficial scientific article titles that are totally misleading. Oh, wait, never mind.
Now, this article has been reported hundreds of times in the press, but they have slightly more interesting headlines, such as "Brontosaurus is back." You guys, I'm sure, have heard about it.
Oh, now I know what they're saying.
Right, what about his back?
So you guys remember our good friend Brontosaurus.
From the Flintstones? Absolutely.
Yeah, the thunder
Brontosaurus
lizard.
Brontosaurus burger.
Brontosaurus is a sauropod, a long-necked vegetarian dinosaur, closely related to Apatosaurus. Or at least that's what we would say today. In the 19th century, during the crazy time when Marsh and other paleontologists were trying to name as many dinosaurs as they could, Marsh actually named one specimen of sauropod Apatosaurus, which means the deceptive lizard. And he was sent another specimen that was similar but different enough that he thought it was another species, so he called it Brontosaurus. Actually, Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus are different genera of, right? So it's genus level difference, not species level.
Okay.
But by 1904, the paleontological community came to believe that Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus were the same genus.
Which means
they weren't different enough to be considered different genera. So they, Apatosaurus was named first, so Brontosaurus went away. There was no need for a Brontosaurus genus. The specimen that was Brontosaurus was made a specific species within the genus Apatosaurus.
Gotcha.
Oh, interesting.
Got it. So it still existed as a species. It just wasn't its own genus. It was no longer Brontosaurus excelsus. It became Apatosaurus excelsus.
Yes.
Something I never understood until I read these recent articles about this new study.
Yeah, that puts a completely different spin than I had. I thought it was more at species level. All right, cool.
Yeah, it's genus level. So the other thing is that you've heard that they had the wrong head on the Apatosaurus.
Yeah.
What?
Silly scientists.
What?
When did that happen?
That has nothing to do with Brontosaurus, the name Brontosaurus going away. That's a myth. And in fact, they knew they didn't have the head with the specimen of either the Apatosaurus or the Brontosaurus. The skulls were not part of the specimen. So they had to infer what the head probably looked like. And they based that on what they thought the closest related species of sauropod was.
Whoa.
And at the time, they thought it was the Camarasaurus. So they made a model of a head off of a Camarasaurus head, and they put that on the Apatosaurus. That was the mistake. It wasn't that they had a skull. Like, oh, we don't know. They didn't literally put the quote-unquote wrong head on the Apatosaurus. They just thought that the head looked like a Camarasaurus because they thought that was the most closely related genus. Later, it was discovered that Diplodocus was probably more closely related to Apatosaurus, and therefore the Apatosaurus probably had a skull that looked more like Diplodocus than Camarasaurus.
Mm-hmm.
That was the correction. They used the wrong model for the head of the Apatosaurus.
Okay.
Now having nothing to do with getting rid of Brontosaurus, that had entirely to do with whether or not you thought Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus specimens were different enough to be considered different species, different genera, or just different species within one genera. Now, fast forward to the new study published April 7th, 2015. By Shop et al. That's T-S-C-H-O-P-P.
Whoa.
I'm going to call that Shop. They did the most extensive analysis of Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus specimens ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And they show convincingly that Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus should be their own genera.
Oh, so they're back to being the same.
Yeah, so they're different. So Brontosaurus exists again. If this becomes generally
Brontosaurus
accepted.
Is no longer a species of
Apatosaurus now, which is its own genus. It's its own genus again. What they showed was that the Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus had as many differences as other separate genera.
That was key.
And more differences than other species level difference, right?
Okay.
So other creatures that are considered different species of the same genus, you know, the Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus were more different from each other than those specimens, and they were as different as other separate genera, right? So if you're just using what's already out there as a standard, it's perfectly reasonable to consider Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus as two different genera. Because they are different enough by their new analysis. So that's why the Brontosaurus is back. It's no longer a species under Apatosaurus. It's its orus. The name Brontosaurus now has been resurrected. Isn't that cool?
Welcome back.
Yeah, which is funny because the culture was maybe just about after well over 100 years, the culture was still saying Brontosaurus.
Yep.
And now we're finally getting used to Brontosaurus being gone. And now it's back. Psych.
Yep.
Every time I hear the word brontosaurus, I think of Brontosaurus Burger.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
It's the alliteration.
It was the iconic dinosaur, right up there with T-Rex.
T-Rex, sure.
Right, right.
Stegosaurus, like Brontosaurus, T-Rex. Those are the like top.
Although I really like a Parasaurolophus myself. But,
you would. Yeah.
Well, you could leave your personal.
So that's cool. I love that. I love that the Brontosaurus is back. And even better, I love that I now understand what the hell cool. actually happened. And then I went back and I said, okay, did I just not read this right? So I went back and I read three or four different, like, older articles explaining why Brontosaurus doesn't exist anymore. And they were all unclear. It's like, nope, everyone really, no one said it the right way as it's currently being described in this paper and in the reporting of this news item. So it really was just poorly reported all this time.
I encounter that a lot as well, Steve. It's just so frustrating. I read an article. I'm like, you know, this is just not clear. I don't think whoever wrote this either doesn't understand precisely what's going on, or they're just not being clear about it. And often I have to read three or four articles like, yep, I finally wrap my head around what the hell's going on.
I hate that. I hate when I'm reading a science news item and I know they're not explaining it right. I can't make sense of it, and it's because they're oversimplifying it to the point of being wrong. They're not hitting the essence of what the actual news item is, and it is incredibly frustrating.
And sometimes I actually give up on a news item because you're like, nope, I'm just not – either I'm stupid and I'm just not quite picking this up, or nobody's explaining it in sufficient enough detail that I'm comfortable relating it to other people.
Yeah, I mean, your only choice at that point is just to do the primary journalism yourself and actually contact the researcher and say, can you please explain this to me so it makes sense? Yeah, but we don't always have time to do that. But when we do, that's what I prefer to do is bypass all this crap and talk to the researcher so they can explain it to
Or if you don't have access to the primary researcher, always go to the primary research itself. And even though, I mean, I've done that, of course, I do that as often as I can. And sometimes it's just so technical to wade through. But even still, even if there are vast sections that are just way over your head, there are still, like in the summary and the abstract and in various other paragraphs, you could find answers to flesh out the ambiguities enough where you could explain it well.
Exactly. I agree. Okay. And sometimes I understand the issue, and so I know exactly why the reporting sucks. Like, it's a medical issue or something which I'm already very familiar with. Anyway, let's move on. Jay, I'm very interested in last week's Who's That Noisy? I'm very curious.
I bet you are. Yeah, it is. It was pretty cool. It's a little complicated. First, here's the noisy. Some people emailed in correctly and said that is Benny Benassi's version of Satisfaction, which they are partially correct. Yes, it is, but that is that particular song, that version of that song written by Benny Benassi, but it was played through, check this out, a Tesla coil.
Yeah, baby. That was awesome.
So the original version, if you look it up on YouTube, you'll hear it. And then the part that I played for you is actually played through a Tesla coil, and you can hear it's very different sounding than the original version. Now, when I say original, I mean not the Rolling Stones version of Satisfaction, but Benny Benassi's version, right? So some other guy took Benny Benassi's version and played it through a Tesla coil. And by the way, it opened up a whole world to me of music played through Tesla coils. I can't believe it. It's so cool.
That's a thing? That's a thing?
Yeah,
wow.
It's a thing. A lot of people came up with the idea and do it, and then they do it to amazingly awesome displays of electricity and all sorts of stuff.
How do they do it?
They have to hook up the music to the Tesla coil, but then I guess it has to be, you know, they're transmitting – interpreting the frequencies into output from the Tesla coil. And when the Tesla coil makes the noise, of course, it's making a gigantic electrical arc. So it's really cool to look at. And in general, just go on YouTube and look up people doing crazy stuff with Tesla coils. Like, it's happening. People are doing all sorts of funky stuff, and it's really cool. Just have fun on YouTube one afternoon. Now, I'm not doing a noisy this week because it's going to be two or three episodes until we record the next show, Steve.
Well, yeah, so the next episode will be our live show from Nexus. The week after that will be our private show from Nexus. The week after that will be our private show from New Zealand, which I haven't used yet. I was saving up. And then the show after that will be our 10-hour show, our 10-hour live streaming show that we're doing. And then we have to get all the way into, I think, the second week in May before we record our next regular show.
Yeah, so I thought it would be too long for people to remember the Noisy and all that. So I figured we'll just wait until that you know, month goes by, and then we'll
reboot at that point.
Yeah, but I do have an awesome one queued up and ready to go.
All right, well, we'll just have to wait for it. Okay, well, let's get to a couple of emails. First one comes from Dwight, who writes, "Saving you all the extra words about how wonderful you and your fellow rogues are, I wanted to point out that you were actually a bit off in your comparison of religions and cults in episode 508. The problem, from my perspective, is one that appeared to be dichotomous thinking. As someone who has begun researching the effect upon atheistic clients when psychotherapists share their belief systems with them, and as a psychotherapist who has heard from clients what they have suffered as they attempted to exit religion, it is quite clear to me that there is a vast continuum of reactions in this area. Clearly, there are the horror stories of former Scientologists and the laissez-faire attitudes of liberal religious people when friends and neighbors part from their church or synagogue. There is, however, a vast and nuanced range of other experiences involving shunning, social marginalization, forced religious interventions, and all manner of slights in between the extremes. I am concerned that sharing a dichotomous attitude as you and the rogues appeared to do in the episode washes out all the gray and gives religious people a place of privilege to continue to engage in the oppression of those who have found the belief system lacking. Thanks for so many hours of work and skepticism. You are a great gift to so many." This was, I think, our second most emailed topic in the last week. The first most popular one was going to be our next question. So, and a lot of people, took exception to my quick characterization of the difference between the point I was making was that the difference between cults and religion is not in what they believe; it's in how they behave. That was the point that I was focusing on, specifically countering Neil deGrasse Tyson's statements, stating that, well, there's no difference because one magical belief is the same as any other magical belief. I was just pointing out, well, that's not really the point. The point is that what makes a cult is how they behave, not the details of their magical beliefs. I didn't get into that in any more detail. I certainly did not mean to imply any strict dichotomy between religion and cult. And in fact, I mentioned specifically the demarcation problem, although again, I didn't describe what I meant by that. So let me go into that in a little bit more detail. I have written about this several times in the past. I did mention that as well. Most recently, I wrote an article on Neurologica in 2010 called The Cult Demarcation Problem. And it specifically describes the fact that that it's not a dichotomy, that there's a continuum with what people would consider a religion at one end of the spectrum and a cult at the other end of the spectrum. But there's everything in between. Just like there's a science versus pseudoscience demarcation problem, there's a cult versus religion demarcation problem. How we would define a cult is by a number of different characteristics, behavioral characteristics of those cults. And the more of those characteristics you have, the more of a cult you are. It doesn't have to be black or white. There's a number of different systems. People have come up with their different lists of characteristics of cults. There's at least a dozen of them that I've read, and they vary tremendously in the number of characteristics that they have. I think it's a lump or splitter division. You know, it's like how finely are you going to split out the characteristics? But here are the basic ones. I pulled out from my article. I think here are the five themes that crop up in everybody's list. One is totalitarian control. Cults attempt to have complete control over their members. This number two is secrecy. They keep the details of their belief system secret and reveal it over time only when you're ready or as you progress deeper and deeper into the folds of the cult. Three is separation. They use some methods to separate you from your family, your former social network, your former life. They cultivate an us versus them, in-group versus out-group mentality. They use jargon to make your identity unintelligible to non-members. They use physical isolation. They try to say that people, anyone who would question the cult is a destructive influence. They make you financially dependent upon the cult. Number four is mind control. They use a series of manipulative techniques to indoctrinate or quote-unquote brainwash their members. These include love bombing, for example, overwhelming recruits with positive physical or social attention, guilt, hypnosis, loss of privacy, deprivation, verbal abuse, harsh work, lots of things that we talked about on about Scientology. And their five is their belief system. And this is really the only thing that is about the belief system. It's a self-contained belief system. But this feeds into the other aspects. The beliefs tend to be absolute. The leader is perfect, has absolute authority, exclusive knowledge, cannot be questioned. Anyone who disagrees with the leader is evil and needs to be opposed. Anyone who leaves the group is wrong and degenerate. That's sort of taking the lumper approach. Those are the five main characteristics, but you could split them up into many, many more specific, detailed characteristics. So, well, I'll link to the article I wrote in 2010. You can read that. It's a good sort of primer on cults with a link to more reading if you're interested. So yes, I agree that it isn't a dichotomy between religion and cults. It's just the more characteristics you have, the more cult-like the belief system or the group is. All right, one more question. This is also a follow-up from last week. This was the most, I think, emailed item.
Oh, yeah.
This one comes from Sancho, and Sancho writes, "Hey, all, I think you guys were talking about two different things when Steve was talking about light calf compression sleeves, but Bob was talking about powerlifting suits. Powerlifting suits are seriously strong. There are two different categories of powerlifting competitions, raw and equipped. Raw competitions don't allow powerlifting suits. The equipped competitions all have higher records at all weight classes." What do you think about that, Bob?
Yeah, I agree. I think we were talking about two different things. The compression sleeves you're talking about that did things like increasing blood flow and proprioception and letting them jump and run better. Yeah, that makes sense that that's bullshit. But I looked at this compression gear for powerlifters. They are different. We're talking about different things, really. Mm-hmm. And the compression gear for powerlifters seems reasonable, and the effects seem pretty obvious to me as well. What's happening is that, yeah, when you, these geared suits for powerlifting they're not simple things that you slip on. It's not a thin material. This is like hardy stuff. This is like, some of it's made of canvas. It's just really, really, it's a different substance. And it takes one or two people just to get the damn things on. And what's happening is that it stores the energy. The suit actually it stretches to store energy so that you may actually need, say, picture you're doing a bench press. You may need hundreds of pounds of weight just to push your arms down to your chest. I mean, just to imagine that. I saw a guy wearing this suit and his arms were like, it forces your arms out in front of you. It looks kind of weird. The world records for benching, for raw, say, for no real aids at all, it's say 700 pounds. If you look at the world record for geared suits, it's 1,000. It's 300 pounds more. And you see that kind of difference over and over. In these world records.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know what you were talking about when you brought that up. I didn't know what you were talking about. You didn't know what I was talking about. So we were just talking about two different things. I looked at it too, Bob. I found the same thing. I found there's actually three different types of weightlifting, powerlifting suits. There's squat suits, bench shirts, and deadlift suits. Although some people say that the squat suits and deadlift suits, You can kind of
don't help as much.
No, you can kind of get away using one suit for both of them, but the dedicated ones, they are a little bit different. And it's not just the storing the energy. One says the squat suits amplify your stretch reflex, for example, helps you get up easier. And yeah, it's basically every powerlifting federation has their own rules.
Yes.
It's more than, as you say, it's more than just raw or
modern
with using uniforms.
Classic raw, modern raw. Yep.
So yeah, do you allow knee braces or knee wraps so some people say this is raw with knee wraps. You know, you have to like get really granular in your description of what the federation rules are. It's not fair to look at it as a cheat. It's just that each federation has its own rules. And as long as you're comparing apples to apples, it doesn't matter. They're just different techniques.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, glad we have that all cleared up. But it is funny when you get to these topics that seem very narrow, like powerlifting gear. How deep you go down that hole when you start to look into it. You know, it's everything is so complicated. Every little subculture has all so much detail with it. You know what I mean? All right. One quick, the dumbest thing I heard this week. Tell me who you think said this. This is now a quote. I am particularly struck that the alleged bombers made use of online bomb making guides like the Anarchist Cookbook and Inspire magazine. These documents are not, in my view, protected by the First Amendment and should be removed from the internet. That was Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's a Democrat from California.
Wow, there's so many things in there that she just doesn't get.
Yeah. Well, the thing that sticks out is the last four words, removed from the internet. That's, I think, what struck people. It's like, not in 2015. No. You just
Here are four more words. The internet is forever.
Yeah, I mean... You can't remove stuff from the internet. And in fact, if you try to do that,
it fights against you.
You're just going to exacerbate it. You're going to make it 10 times worse. People will see the effort to remove something from the internet and will replicate it a million times.
People will tattoo the thing you're trying to remove on their faces.
It becomes the latest meme.
Yeah, it's funny. So the Gizmodo article about it says, I'm not sure the senator knows how the internet works. Now, to her credit, she didn't call it the intertubes or think that it's a series of tubes.
Okay. That's good.
But,
that's
and good. I understand, you know, why you,
or the information super,
why you would want to control this information. It's, you know, telling people how to make bombs from stuff in their kitchen or whatever stuff that you could legally obtain. But whatever, the information's out there. It's too late. It is out there. There's nothing you can do to control it. It's just
the horse has left the barn.
Yeah, pretty much. 1,000 horses have left the barn.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Big sweep last week. Big sweep. You guys ready to recover?
No, I'm still pissed off.
Okay. No, it was painful.
It was glorious. All right, here we go. Let's see if you could do better this week. Ready? Mm-hmm. Item number 1, researchers unveil a prototype aluminum ion battery with almost 10 times the capacity by weight of current lithium ion batteries. Item number 2, a new medical report indicates that food allergies can be transmitted through blood product transfusions. And item number 3, a new study finds that the sun has a near quasi-annual or 2-year seasonal fluctuation in solar activity. Evan, go first.
A prototype aluminum ion battery. 10 times the capacity and weight. Oh, come on. As we all know, battery technology is a slow crawl. Slow crawl. Which is why this particular item stands out. Moving on. Medical report. Food allergies can be transmitted through blood product transfusions. The allergies. So what's the allergen that's in food and can it survive process of running through the liver and everything and still be in the blood by the time you go to take it out and send it to somebody else? Can they pick up the allergens? I suppose so. So I'm not going to rule that out. The last one, the sun has a near quasi-annual 2-year seasonal fluctuation in solar activity. I'm going to go with the sun. I really don't have a good feeling for that at all. So I'm going to say that void in my knowledge base is going to reveal that one's the fiction. So the sun is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
A new seasonal fluctuation with solar activity. I'm surprised that hasn't been detected up until now. It must be fairly subtle, I would think. But that's interesting if that's true. I kind of hope it is. That would be cool. The food allergy one, man, shit. It doesn't make sense. I just know so little about how that would even possibly work. What would it be in blood that could, blood product transfusions? It's not completely out there, but I just don't have much to say about it. All right, the aluminum ion battery. I'm just I think battery technology, you know what I'm going to say, Steve. It's got to be the most frustrating of news items. They're all over the place. You see a battery advance. I can't even imagine how many I've read, but they, you know, there's always some major aspect of it that they don't report on that just that gives it the death blow that you never hear about it. And this, you know, could easily be one of them. It just doesn't make that much sense that it would have 10 times the capacity of lithium ion batteries. That's typically not the breakthrough. The breakthrough is more akin to, you know, the speed of charging, which would make more sense. So, I think I'm going to go with the battery one as fiction.
And Jay,
I'm going to start with you suck, Steve. And I'll explain that after you do the reveal.
Good start, Jay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is very frustrating for me. Okay, so the aluminum ion battery has 10 times the capacity. I'm not sure about the details of this one, so let me go to the next one. This medical report that food allergies can be transmitted through blood product transfusions. Very interesting. Okay, so you have a food allergy. I'm dying to know what the mechanism of this would be. So what's in the blood that can actually, in a way, kind of give the other person a food allergy? Maybe what they're giving them is the reaction to the food allergy. Like the donor is having a food allergy. It manifests itself somehow in their blood. And then the recipient of the donor blood then has a similar reaction because it's in the blood, but maybe they don't like get the actual food allergy. You know what I mean? Like they don't acquire a new food allergy because of it. They're just temporarily suffering the symptoms. Maybe that makes sense to me. I could see that happening. Okay. This last one, son has a near quasi annual. The word quasi reminds me of Dr. Evil for some reason. I'm just saying. I mean, I don't see any reason why not. Okay. A new study finds that the sun, you know, we already know that the sun goes through cycles and does different things. Well, all right. Since I am partially educated in all things batteries, I think that there's something wrong with the first one. So I'm going to say that one's the fake.
The battery one.
Right.
So you guys all agree that a new medical report indicates that food allergies can be transmitted through blood product transfusions. Am I going to sweep you again with this one?
Nope.
What do you think? Nobody would. Total silence.
Total silence.
This one total is...
Science.
Science.
Yeah, baby.
Science.
Ooh. Cool, man. How's that work?
So, Evan, hey. it's not the allergens. It's the antibodies that are being transfused with the blood products, specifically IgE or immunoglobulin E, which is the type of antibody that mediates allergic reactions. This is a very rare complication. And Jay, you're correct. You temporarily transfer the food allergy, but you don't make the person permanently allergic to that food.
Awesome.
But it can happen up to a few months following a transfusion. For example, you can have an anaphylactic reaction to peanuts, even though you've never had an allergic reaction to peanuts before. So this is a case series reporting on cases where this has occurred. So very rare, very interesting. Not something you really need to worry about too much, but, you know, it is possible. You can get an allergic reaction in the months following a transfusion.
Wow. Okay, cool.
Interesting.
So it's called passive transfer. It's passive transfer of allergies through a blood transfusion. Okay, let's go on to number one.
Uh-oh.
Researchers unveil a prototype aluminum ion battery with almost 10 times the capacity by weight of current lithium ion batteries. Bob and Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Evan, you think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Oh!
Yeah, baby.
I, of course, read this news item.
Yes.
I just didn't know 10 times the capacity, blah, blah, blah.
Read the details.
Well, I don't remember.
I did.
What the hell?
Okay. Yep. This is typical battery research where they make a breakthrough in one feature, but it's not quite there in every feature. But this one looks pretty good.
It does. It does.
The breakthrough that the Stanford team made was to use graphite cathode. So it's aluminum anode and a graphite cathode along with an ionic liquid electrolyte. One advantage is it can be flexible. So this could be good for certain electronic devices. It charges quickly. It has many charge-discharge cycles. The Stanford battery, they say, was able to withstand 7,500 cycles. A typical lithium-ion battery will last about 1,000 cycles, so that's more. It is fairly light. So it's light, durable, Lots of charge recharge cycles can be charged very, very quickly, and it's flexible. And this is really critical. It's cheaper. The aluminum is cheaper than the lithium.
Awesome.
So I love it when it's like when scientists or engineers make a battery out of platinum or something. Oh yeah, that's really going to be useful. But anyway, what's the caveat though? What's the feature that isn't great that could be a deal killer?
I don't remember them saying it actually.
It doesn't have a very high capacity. So the big thing is that it can, so far they've only gotten up to 2 volts, generating 2 volts. So it doesn't generate that much voltage. Although, you know, AA and AAA batteries are 1.5 volts. So it's within the range of usability for certain applications. You're not going to be driving around with an electric car using this battery though.
But if it charges in 1 minute, I mean, I think it's in 1 minute. I mean, that's.
Well, it depends on how big the battery is.
Yeah. Okay.
It has high speed charging. Yeah. So it's also very safe. You could puncture this thing. It's not going to explode. So that's another feature. So it's safer than lithium ion batteries. So inexpensive, safe, high speed, flexible, long cycle life, but doesn't have the capacity or the voltage yet. So as always, they say, as long as we fix those two problems, you know, then.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, those do not seem like deal killers. Those could be compatible with this technology. In other words, getting the voltage up higher, getting the capacity within the range. This isn't going to be something that's going to increase the range of cars. But hey, if you could take a $20,000 battery and make something that's almost as good for $10,000 or whatever, and that doesn't have as many toxic chemicals in it, that's still good. You know, that still could be a huge advance, even if the range doesn't increase, or the computer life or whatever it is you're charging up with it, and not blowing up. That's a huge advantage too, not catching on fire.
Hey, Ever, aren't you pissed off?
No, Evan's an adult, Jay.
That I'm even still here.
You mean here on the show?
Yeah.
All right, let's go. You're just grateful every week.
Yes, thank you, Steve.
Just
I am
every
an
week.
Adult.
You're just
thank
happy
you very
to be
much.
Here.
I do appreciate it.
I'm all right.
To be alive.
Item number three: a new study finds that the sun has a near quasi-annual or two-year seasonal fluctuation in solar activity. That, of course, is science. What is interesting about this is that they're just discovering this now. But this is it's not that subtle. But it's not that it's so subtle. But yeah, there's the sun is complicated. The sun's weather is very complicated. It goes through a lot of different cycles. This is a magnetic cycle, like the 11-year sunspot cycle, which is actually a 22-year magnetic polarity cycle. But what they found is that layered on top of that is this almost 2-year magnetic cycle, and that the activity does increase. It waxes and then wanes over this sort of 2-year period, and that this can affect the maximums and the minimums of the 11-year cycle. So this understanding of the solar activity, and this basically comes from, there's different bands of magnetism that are moving past each other, and that's what's causing the changes in solar activity, and that can, for example, bring up energy from deeper within the sun, and that can cause the coronal mass ejections and solar flares, for example. So this could give us an improved ability to predict solar weather by, again, giving us another cycle.
That is awesome.
You know, that we can follow. So yeah, that was pretty
cool.
So good job, Bob and Jay.
Yes.
Good job. All right. Evan, Batters. Do you have a quote for us this week?
I suppose I do. Here we go. If anyone can show me and prove to me that I am wrong in thought or deed, I will gladly change. I seek the truth, which never yet hurt anybody. It is only persistence in self-delusion and ignorance which does harm. That could have been spoken by a great number of people throughout history.
Cool.
However, there was only one who said it, and it was, in fact, Marcus Aurelius.
That's what makes that profound.
It's cool that somebody said that thousands of years ago.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Frickin-lutely. He was a Roman emperor from the year 161 to 180. He was considered the last of the five good emperors, and is also considered one of the most important Stoic philosophers. And did you know that an anagram for Marcus Aurelius is Samurai Ulcer Us. No, that's not really, it is actually, but that's not what I'm really going for. Did you know that Aurelius married his first cousin, Faustina the Young, named Faustina the Younger? Not exactly a politically correct thing these days, however.
Yeah, but until modern times, modern no big deal. Marry your first cousin.
Yeah, I guess you're okay, genetically speaking.
All the nobles of Europe did it.
Right. Keep it in the family and all. And look how they turned out. During their 30-year marriage, Faustina bore 13 children. But only five of the children outlived the father.
Wow.
So did you know that? No, you
did not know that.
Now you know.
On June 6th, SkepticalCon.com, that's the Skeptical one-day conference. You should definitely go see this. This conference is actually a wonderful conference to go to. It's at the Oakland Asian Cultural Center in California. You can go to www.skepticalcon.org for more information. That's on June 6th. And also, I was recently interviewed by Sheldon Helms, who is also a part of the people that organize SkepticalCon. And Sheldon has a new podcast called Shell Shocked, which I thought was a perfect name. If you know Sheldon, it's very funny. That's all one word with one L. You can go to SheldonHelms.com/Shell Shocked to hear that interview. We had a good time chatting with each other.
Hey, Jay, do you know how many pieces of premium content we have for our premium members of the SGU?
42.
We have exactly 50
pieces
of premium content.
I was kidding. I was close. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So 50, which means that if you become a premium member, which is at least $8 per month of the SGU, in addition to ad-free episodes, you get access to our library of premium content, which now has 50 and growing. We add new content all the time. These are hour-long interviews with all the rogues, extra bits that we do for the show that didn't make it into the final episode. Sometimes we record things specifically for premium content. We do have a couple of videos there. We have a lot more content coming your way through the premium content. If you can't get enough of the SGU, there's hours and hours of additional material as a thank you for supporting the SGU by becoming a member. So
it really,
please check it out.
It really does help, guys. I mean, you know, it just helps us pay to produce the show and, you know, all the other activities that we do, like Steve's efforts recently to want to push libel reform in the United States and a lot of other stuff.
Or the 10-hour live show that we're going to be doing on May 2nd.
That's right.
That was all made possible by support from our members.
Absolutely. And if you have not seen, all four episodes of OCK are now up. I would love to get your feedback on there. Some guys on Facebook... I mean, I'm sorry. Some guys on YouTube are making very funny comments. YouTube comments are crazy, right, guys? What's with YouTube, man?
It's the Wild West.
But we finally finished, and all the backer awards are going out over the next few weeks as we find time to make the final shipments out to those who didn't get their stuff. That's coming. I'd like to formally thank everyone that helped me with this project. It was 2 years of my life, and now you can see all four episodes up on our YouTube channel. And we have other things on the YouTube channel. We have some funny skits that we did at TAM last year. They're all basically around the idea of us playing D&D with different people. And there's three of them up now. We have about four or five more to go and more videos to come in the coming months.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Doc.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.